If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Medicine in America, hosted by Anthony Manson and Todd Harrington, shares the stories of physicians, other healthcare professionals, and industry leaders who are changing the way we deliver care. There's an episode that you should check out called Primary Care Reimagined with Subscription-Based Preventative Care Model. It's an inspiring call for a paradigm shift in primary care. All of their episodes highlight innovative ideas at the forefront of the movement to transform our healthcare system. Check out Medicine in America on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to Iowa Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. This is episode 103 of the podcast. If you're a new listener, I want to welcome you. Iowa Health is your place for trusted health guidance and resource. Whether you're looking to improve your health or just seeking ways to stay well, we're here for you. This growing community is on a mission to improve our state of being and experience together on the planet. Today, I've got Dr. Bonnie Goldstein on the show. She's the medical director of Canna Centers Wellness and Education, a California-based medical practice devoted to educating parents about the use of cannabis for serious and chronic medical conditions. After years of working in pediatric emergency medicine, she developed an interest in the science of medical cannabis after witnessing its beneficial effects with an ill friend, which she shares with me here in our conversation. Over the last 13 years, she has evaluated thousands of patients for the use of medical cannabis and is recognized as an expert in the clinical application of cannabis therapeutics. She advised on the documentary Weediatrics, A Covert Medical Mission, and her latest book, Cannabis is Medicine, How Medical Cannabis and CBD Are Healing Everything from Anxiety to Chronic Pain, is now available. Here is my conversation with Dr. Bonnie Goldstein. How did you get involved with this film in the first place?
I wasn't involved in it. I just think what happened was I met the producers and the people involved in doing it because I have focused on pediatric cannabis treatment for the last, 8 years or so. I've been a cannabis physician for 13 years.
Okay.
After being a pediatric emergency medicine doctor for about 14 years. So I trained as a pediatrician, did critical care transport in pediatric ER, and then ended up transitioning around 2007, 2008 into the cannabis world after a friend of mine was sick and asked me about it. I didn't know anything. I started reading about it and I was like, how do I not know about this, right? Yeah. How do mainstream doctors not know that there's this tool, that's so safe when used medically, you know? And I think that's the whole thing is that, you know, you're fighting all the brainwashing. But anyway, for the movie, I had heard about the movie and then I was, got to meet the people who made the movie and I kind of got involved that way.
Yeah. And so when you got involved, was your friend, was it cancer treatment that you first became aware of?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct. It was a friend with cancer who had a good prognosis, but a tough treatment. And it broke her. I mean, she's just a person whose day-to-day life was filled with, you know, early morning till late at night, busy, 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 working, kids, husband, community, and just it all stopped.
Yeah.
And in addition to fearing the typical things that you fear when you get cancer, which is, am I going to die? Am I going to see my children grow up? Am I going to die before my parents? You know, all the awful things that you go through your head.
Yeah.
She had tremendous physical side effects from the chemo. She was just one of those people who, like, when they give you a list, she had 90% of them.
Yeah.
So for her, cannabis, what it did for her was a multitude of things. And that's why I think it impressed me so much, right? Yeah. In front of my face, I saw a great response. She physically felt better, meaning able to eat dinner with the kids at the table.
Yeah.
Able to take, you know, not out exercising like she used to be, but walk around the block, right? Yeah. Without wanting to lay down on the next door, only making it to the next driveway. Remember, she said that I could only walk to the driveway next door and come home. And she was so excited she had made it around the block. But mental, I can get through this. My anxiety's down, sleeping at night.
Right.
I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, kind of that, you know, lifted the severe burden of what a cancer diagnosis means.
Yeah, that, I mean, that was my, probably right around the same time, maybe a little earlier, like 2005, I was treating someone who was a judge in New York who had gone through this, you know, whole round of different things for a kidney cancer of some sort. And so it was like a slow process, you know, before they finally found out what it was. And then they kind of got me involved at the time that they wanted to start doing some just support work. And then I kind of learned that they were starting to use cannabis for him, and it made a huge difference. And I got to sort of be there, and, you know, they same kinds of things you're talking about, just the day-to-day things where, you know, able to go for walks, and they had kids, and, you know, able to be more present that way. And so that was the beginning of it for me of even considering that it could be a something with medical usage. And then, you know, fast forward, I guess maybe right. somewhere around 2013, I also started treating somebody, a child with some severe seizure issues, and started hearing about it. But again, it was sort of, you know, everything had to kind of happen under the radar. And, you know, the thing that brought me into the film, and I've covered this topic a little bit on the podcast before, but I think, and I also do some work with seizure and with autism. Mm-hmm. And so, those were the two big things in the film, that realizing how difficult it was for these parents to actually get access. And so in your work now, so since you've been doing this, what's the access like?
Sure. Well, it depends on where you live, which
right.
is a crime.
California?
I'm in California.
Yeah.
So California, remember, we're the first to have a medical law in 1996.
Yeah.
It was called the Compassionate Use Act. It was, you know, we used to say good news and the bad news is the same. It's, not, you know, not a very well-written law because it left a lot of areas ambiguous. So, you know, people were negotiating it, and then you'd get in trouble and say, well, that's how I interpret the law. And then law enforcement interprets it a little bit differently.
Right.
So it was really, as people said, the Wild West.
Yeah.
You know, parents are always going to do what they need to do for their children. Although in the movie, as you saw, many of them were terrified of getting in trouble and getting their children taken away.
Yeah.
I've been involved in about, luckily, only 7 or 8 child protective service cases where CPS came in and somebody made some referral. And it was investigated. And, you know, I had to get involved to say, look, there's science behind this. And these are children who have had, you know, where the parents have seen 10 different doctors, where they've tried 20 different drugs, where
yeah.
there truly is nothing left on the table. And, you know, I think it's criminal that you have to, that this would be a last resort, because
right.
my goodness, why wouldn't you use the benign plant first before you use drugs in a child's developing brain that
right.
we know what those drugs do? And cannabis, again, it's a plant, and this idea that it's going to destroy a child's brain. Well, what do you think 50 seizures a day does?
Right.
What do you think when you have a child who has autism who hits their head on concrete because they don't feel pain
yeah.
and they just sit and bang their head, you know, all day long? I mean, we have to look at these things from a different perspective. Meaning not look at it from the perspective of the prohibitionist. We
right.
have to look at it from the scientist. And what there's a concept we use, harm reduction. You've probably heard that term before.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, I joke around that my husband calls me a chicken in a mommy suit, that if you unzip me, there's a chicken inside, right? I'm a very conservatively trained physician.
Yeah.
You know, fairly conservative person in I'm not a risk taker and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always following the rules and
yeah.
and cannabis is safe. especially when medically supervised by somebody who knows what they're doing. And to think that I'm just, you know, me or anybody like me or handing out, getting little kids high, that is not what we're doing. My goodness. You saw in the movie, the one thing that stands out, the parents are so not cavalier.
Yeah.
They're so not, well, we'll just give them some cannabis and see what happens. I mean, they agonize over the decision. These are good people who want the best for their children, and they find themselves in this terrible situation of their child who has significant challenges that modern medicine is not able to address.
Yeah.
And I think anybody would agree with me that, you know, that all options that are safe should be on the table. Look, we are giving children with autism antipsychotic medications with a list of side effects, including irreversible side effects, as long as your arm, okay? And they don't actually make the child better. They're meant to treat the irritability of autism.
Yeah.
Okay? So basically, let's tranquilize the kid.
Yeah.
Now, look, we got lots of drugs. I could make a kid, you know, lay down all day. You won't get up from the couch, won't bother you, won't go to school, won't interfere.
Right.
Hey, you know, you might have to force them to eat. Like, what is the point of that?
What
We're
kind
trying
of life
to get
is
kids
that?
Functional.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when we think about cannabis, you can't think about the, you know, like the typical, like, you know, I hate to call out Cheech and Chong, but that kind of thing. We're not, you know, that's a movie and that's one side of it, but it's, and you know, that whole stoner side of it is kind of what's implanted in everybody's brain.
Yeah.
But you have to remember that prior to cannabis becoming kind of controversial in the 1930s and 40s, where they, you know, really started the process of taking it away from us.
Yeah.
It was used as medicine.
Yeah.
For thousands of years.
Yeah.
And here we are, we come along and we take it away for non-scientific, non-medical reasons, which, you know, I don't want to go into, but the whole, you know, replacing hemp with, you know, paper from timber and with nylon, you know, they wanted to introduce new compounds. So how do you get rid of it? Well, you do this, you know, racist propaganda and brainwash everybody and get rid of it. And they did a very good job, didn't they? Because here we are in 2021 still talking about it and still talking about access. So here in California, access is actually fairly easy. Anybody under 21, if you're considered a, you know, a minor, you have to have a doctor's letter. And contrary to what some legislators think, 15-year-olds don't walk into my office without their parents and get a cannabis letter. That's not the way it works.
Right.
I require medical records up front. And then and only then can you get an appointment. And of course, parents are here. And usually we're using the non-impairing, you know, meaning non-THC cannabinoids, but we include THC when it's necessary. And the way to think about THC is that it's replacing a compound that your brain makes to help balance your cellular messages. And if you've ever seen someone having seizures, you can tell the cellular messages are not balanced.
Right.
A child having a rage episode with autism, their cellular messages are not balanced.
Yeah.
It turns out that they may have less of their inner cannabis, and we're just replacing it. It's like giving somebody insulin who doesn't make insulin, or giving somebody vitamin D who doesn't make vitamin D.
So explain. With that, you know, and with the history of use as medicine, why do we have this endocannabinoid system in the first place? I mean, what do we know about that system?
Sure. Well, so it's evolved over thousands and thousands and thousands of years as a, you know, I call it a physiologic regulator, but it's a protective mechanism. It's like, think about wound healing, right? You slice your skin with a little knife and 3 days later, you're healed for the most part in a healthy person. When you develop cancer in your body goes into a mode to try to kill the cancer. And sometimes you win and sometimes, you know, the cancer develops. Mm-hmm. But we have all these protective mechanisms. Very simply, you know, another mechanism is to think about, you eat a candy bar, your sugar goes up, your body recognizes that, kicks out insulin and brings it down. Why? Because high sugar, it turns out, is not very good for you, right?
Right?
So This is just another mechanism in the body, another system, again, that tells cells to send balanced messages. So we are constantly kind of, I liken us to a boat on the ocean, and we're kind of floating along, and all these little systems are kicking in to keep the boat right.
Yep.
But when you get a wave, so in some type of traumatic insult, right? A head injury, a car accident, a broken bone, or an illness, or inflammation, anything that tips, what happens is your body, just like the way high sugar triggers an insulin response, this external insult or even an internal insult kicks out these, it triggers your endocannabinoid system to make compounds called endocannabinoids. Mm-hmm. Endo from within, cannabinoid, kind of compound it is, mm-hmm. inner cannabis compounds that basically are a feedback loop that the cells sending kind of this, you know, alert, right? Message. Yeah. The cells receiving that message will say, gee, that's too much message. Let me tell that cell to dial it down. And your body kicks out these inner cannabis compounds that go backwards to the sending cell and say, just dial it down a little. So when you think about pain, that's an over message. Now it's adaptive, but it's still an over message, right? Yeah. Nausea, like you get chemo and you have this overwhelming response of I'm being poisoned and you get severe nausea and vomiting. Again, an over adaptive, but an over message.
Yeah.
Seizures, over-firing, right? Children with autism, when you watch them, they're hyperactive, they're irritable, they're, you know, kind of just taking, you know, I have a lot of parents that say, moving my child from one activity to another, they just lose it, mm-hmm. right? They don't like that transition. That's typical of children with autism. There's like an overstimulation or what we call neuroexcitation, where the brain is sending too much message. And this is one of the mechanisms, your endocannabinoid system, to help those cells just dial it down a little bit. And it's a survival in the way that it's highly dense within your gut, your brain, and your immune system. And when you think about kind of everyday functioning, those three systems are systems that are inherent to good health.
Right, and it's a lot of
inflammation.
It's a lot of what I treat. I always kind of think of my work as being kind of an autonomic nervous system regulator. You know, there's a part of what we're always trying to work on with people. You know, in the situations that you're talking about, a lot of times it's a perception of the mind or the nervous system or something where there's a perceived danger, even if it's just a transition from, you know, someplace into a car that can, you know, for someone who's really struggling in that way, their system isn't able to regulate that, those kinds of transitions. And that's where these kinds of things become useful. And you know, we're not talking about adults here, but I think part of the, you know, the use that adults have used this for over the years has been kind of related to that, where people kind of end up in these, you know, cycles of fight or flight because of, you know, periods mm-hmm. of extreme stress or traumas. And, you know, this kind of leads into maybe the next part of this, which is then it's a matter of dosing, right? Of kind of figuring out ratios. And there's clearly been a lot of work going on with this for a long time. So we're starting to get a pretty good sense. So with in your work, how do you figure out those kinds of ratios?
Right. Well, so the first thing I try to decide, of course, is what's the goal of treatment, right? Yeah. What are we targeting? And sometimes people have one or two things that need treatment, and then some people have a whole slew of things, and we kind of start here, and we always say we're not going to get everything right out of the gate.
Right.
So let's address some of the issues. You know, for adults, pain, anxiety, and poor sleep are the main things that we, you know, almost all conditions boil down to.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I saw with my friend and probably what you saw as well. And if
indigestion.
You can get, if you can get those things under control, people start to feel better, right? And often, you know, chronic illness leads to, well, and this is what we talk about endocannabinoid deficiency or depletion or dysfunction. The system's not working well, and that's why cannabis, when you add it in, whatever cannabinoid you're using, it helps augment that system. So, it, you know, right. it's running a little bit yeah. better. It's like putting oil in the engine, right? Yeah. And so what I try to do is first focus in on, you know, the diagnosis and do we have understanding from the scientific literature of what will help this. So, for instance, children with seizures, we know that high CBD, low THC often can be very helpful. We've got lots of studies now on pediatric epilepsy and how it responds to CBD. And so, you know, for instance, with a child with epilepsy, I would start with high CBD, low THC, mm-hmm. and what we say is start low and go slow. But we have an idea of dosing range, and yeah. we start low, and we allow the patient's response to dictate the titration.
Right.
Some people need low dose. Some people need high dose. This is not a standard like pharmaceutical that has this narrow window of, you know, therapeutic range and, you know, you're somewhere in this dose. Because the reality is that, again, the one thing, if you read the literature and read the studies on cannabis, every study says safe and well-tolerated, safe and well-tolerated, minor yeah. side effects. I mean, yeah. it's just over and over and over again. So it completely destroys the narrative that was fed to us that it's bad for us. So that's one thing I always try to get across is that, especially under medical supervision, especially starting out low dose and titration and letting your response dictate. I do not start people at 300 milligrams of CBD right out of the gate.
Yeah.
What if your dose is 100? Why would I commit you to 300? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to do that.
Which is really no different than any other medication or treatment. I mean, even when I'm treating, because I do manual therapy, some mm-hmm. I do, you know, very gentle osteopathic work with some people, especially if I know that they've been in a pain cycle for a while, if I can tell there's a lot of emotional or mental stressors kind of going on with the person. If I was to use, you know, deep tissue massage or trigger point therapy in those situations, that might be too much for a system, you know. So it's that
seems
like a good example. Even though we're talking about physical pressure on a person, the same kinds of things happen internally.
It's the same.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. And but remember, in the pharmaceutical world, with, you know, there's a range of dosing, and someone may start here, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, for instance, you take some a woman who weighs 115 pounds and, you know, is 5'2". And yet the drug that she's being given was studied in 180-pound men.
Right.
You know, this is not, so the way, basically what I'm telling you is cannabis is not one size fits all. Each person has their unique response. Their endocannabinoid system is coded by your DNA.
Right.
The same way we have different hair and different eye color and heights and the shape of our faces and noses is this idea of we're all different too. Our endocannabinoid system is similar in its function. But you may have, I know people who are super sensitive and take 1 milligram of THC at night to sleep. And then I have other patients that need 20 milligrams,
yeah.
you know, and 1 milligram didn't do anything for them. And so why is there this wide variation? Well, because we're all different.
Yeah.
And the way we respond, the way we absorb these compounds is different. We metabolize them differently. We all definitely have different metabolism and excretion. So we have to be aware of that when dictating treatment. One other example I'll just give you. So let's say a child comes to me who has, let's say, severe aggression and self-injurious behavior, mm-hmm. Injurious to others, severe hyperactivity. I might start them with a little more THC in the mix. I always include CBD. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons is we know that it can help prevent tolerance to THC. So one of the downsides of THC, even though it's extremely useful medication, is that mm-hmm. if used on a regular basis and in higher doses, you can develop tolerance.
Right.
And what happens there is that the receptors where the THC binds to, which, by the way, don't exist for THC, they exist for the for your inner cannabis compounds.
Yep.
But if you constantly hit those receptors over and over and over, there's like a self-preservation mechanism built in where those receptors will pull into the cell and hide.
Yeah.
And now the THC can't reach them. So in order to get more, to get the same effect, you have to take a higher dose. And that's the concept of tolerance, okay? And it's not exclusive to cannabis. There are other, other compounds like opiates and whatnot that also have tolerance issues. So if I was to design a medication, I don't would not design one with tolerance. However, that is the way it goes. That's how it works.
Yep.
And so I always include some CBD in the mix if a patient can tolerate it, again, depending on their response.
Yeah.
But I find the lower ratios, like 1-to-1, half CBD, half THC, sometimes a little more THC than CBD, sometimes a little more CBD than THC, but not the real big gap like I use with the kids with epilepsy.
Okay.
Sometimes those lower ratios are so beneficial for someone who has rage, you know, aggression, self-injurious behavior. It just knocks it out. And interestingly, one thing I'd like to point out is that there's now a number of studies, a couple of studies that came out just within the last few years that were able to measure some of the endocannabinoid levels in children with autism.
Mm.
And across the board, there are statistically significantly lower levels of their endocannabinoids in their bloodstream. Now, remember, your endocannabinoids are made in lots of different parts of your body in your brain. They're made when you need them. They're released. They bind to the receptor. And then enzymes come along and break them down. So they're what we call short-lived molecules. So it's they're not necessarily floating around in large amounts for us to be able to measure very easily.
Yeah.
And you really don't want me going into your brain to measure them.
Right.
So they've designed, there's a couple of ways that it's that they can be measured from the blood. And again, the endocannabinoid levels are low in children with autism. So basically they have a deficiency.
Yeah.
Do we leave them with that deficiency? No, we should treat the deficiency, especially when the compound is responsible for creating balanced cellular messages in the brain and the gut. And we think about children with autism, there are three areas of difficulty: brain, gut, immune system. Well, where's the endocannabinoid system heavily located? Brain, gut, immune system. There's an overlap there.
Yeah.
And so it's exciting right now in 2021 because there's a fair amount of research going on. And if you don't mind, I'd like to share some research that I'm doing right now.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So I've paired with a company that measures what they call cannabis-responsive biomarkers. So they collect saliva and they can look at chemical pathways related to cellular functioning. And they have a whole slew of what's called cannabis-responsive biomarkers. And for instance, one particular biomarker has been associated with aggression. And so we've collected saliva before and after cannabis treatment to see what happens in children with autism. And we've compared that to children who don't have autism. And it's fascinating that children who have pre-cannabis treatment abnormalities, meaning their biomarkers are not within the physiologic range, they're below or above.
Okay.
In many of their cases, their post-cannabis treatment biomarkers have corrected into the physiologic range, whether it's low or high, balance. And that's a really fascinating concept. So that paper is going to be coming out in the next couple of months. And it's very exciting because it is objective data.
Yeah.
Showing that cannabis can push your chemistry into a normal physiologic range and into balance. And remember, when a parent tells me, we had a great day, he didn't hit himself, he didn't bite himself, he didn't have 50 seizures, whatever it is, right? That's great, but in the world of science, people want hard data.
Yeah.
Okay. When parents tell me their child's well, I believe them because many of them tell me, oh, we're not there yet, or it's not working. And there's still a lot of room for improvement. But the parents don't lie. This is, they want help and they don't lie saying, oh yeah, he's better or she's better when they're not. They just don't do that. I don't find that parents do that.
Yeah,
this is not a game, right? There's no benefit to them to lie.
Yeah.
So when they say, but again, a lot of people say, oh, it's just anecdotal.
Right.
Right. It's just anecdotal. Well, this, is, not really the, evidence.
Hasn't this been a problem, though, in terms of the, isn't there a U.S. patent on research? Has that been problematic for publishing?
Well,
or?
Yeah. So this is looking at something that's, you know, outside really of the cannabis world. These are kids that were already being treated under my care. We didn't change their cannabis regimen. We didn't give them cannabis for the study. So we're allowed to do this. All we did was look at biomarkers.
Okay.
The cannabis was just, and whatever other medicine that they might be taking, they're on that too. So there was no, it was just observation of children already using cannabis.
Okay.
So now, I'm not allowed to take a group of patients who don't use cannabis and then split them up into two groups and give half a placebo and half cannabis, because then what is my treatment drug? It's cannabis, and that is still a Schedule I, controlled substance, illegal for me to study without federal approval.
Right.
And we are hopefully at the beginning of the end of that.
Okay.
The DEA did just start, after years of saying they would do this, they just started approving cultivators of cannabis to allow their product to be used in studies. And this is a big problem, is that you tell me we need more studies, right? So the medical community is saying we need more studies, but yet the federal government's saying, no, you can't study it. And if we do approve a study, you have to use cannabis from the federal government. So it comes from a farm at the University of Mississippi.
Okay.
And I don't want to say anything badly, but the cannabis there does not reflect what we call real world cannabis. What you can walk into a dispensary in California or Colorado or New York and purchase is not what is being doled out for research purposes. Why am I comparing apples with oranges? Right? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This is kind of the stuff that I wanted to get out. And I haven't been able to talk to anybody who's really doing as much on the ground as you are. You seem like, of all the people I've had conversations with around the topic, especially in peds, it seems like that's the most I've seen. I work with a couple of docs here, functional medicine-wise and pediatric-wise here at the University of Minnesota. But it's still very limited here in terms of use. I feel like California is way ahead of us.
Right. Yeah, there's still a lot of fear, unfortunately. And, we're combating decades of propaganda.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to change minds. And look, I know a lot of doctors who talk to their patients, you know, behind that door in that doctor-patient relationship or doctor-parent relationship where they say, oh, it's great that you're using this. I'm thrilled that you're doing it. It sounds like your child's doing well and they're on board, but yet they're terrified to say anything outside of the office, in that intimate relationship because they fear for their medical license or they fear they might be considered fringe.
Yeah.
All I can say is, again, I'm a fairly conservative doctor. That to me, this is just another tool in the toolbox. And as a scientist, look, I studied science and became a doctor. Many people, you study science, become a researcher. You study science and help the environment, right?
Yeah.
Science is what science is. I put blinders on and said, I'm going to look at this from my science perspective.
Yeah.
And when you look at it from that, that helps. That all the propaganda, you really do have to push it away. It took me a few years to get there. So I understand with my colleagues that that's something that they're fighting. But if you really just look at the science, the potential uses of this, again, another tool in the toolbox.
Exactly.
It's you're not going to harm anybody, and you may really make a huge difference in a child's life and in an adult's life, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks so much, Bonnie. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know you're busy. And
thank you so much for having me.
And nice to be connected.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Take care.
Dr. Bonnie Goldstein, folks. I hope this gives you a little more insight into the use of cannabis for treatment and why we need to improve the ability to publish this research and have better access to monitored cannabis care by quality providers. I'm grateful to her for taking the time to share her experience and for all the efforts she's making to improve education and access to this type of care. I'd love to know what you thought of this topic and conversation. You can reach me anytime through the contact page on our website, highway2.health. That's highwayto.health. And if you'd like to watch us have this conversation, head over to the Highway to Health podcast channel on YouTube and check out Dr. Bonnie Goldstein's latest book, Cannabis is Medicine, How Medical Cannabis and CBD Are Healing Everything from Anxiety to Chronic Pain. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.
If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Medicine in America, hosted by Anthony Manson and Todd Harrington, shares the stories of physicians, other healthcare professionals, and industry leaders who are changing the way we deliver care. There's an episode that you should check out called Primary Care Reimagined with Subscription-Based Preventative Care Model. It's an inspiring call for a paradigm shift in primary care. All of their episodes highlight innovative ideas at the forefront of the movement to transform our healthcare system. Check out Medicine in America on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.